LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Kingsley Dennis, who joins us to discuss his new book, The Phoenix Generation: A New Era of Connection, Compassion, and Consciousness. Humanity is entering a momentous phase in its history. Being born today is a generation of children that will radically reinvent human society, moving our culture from competition, control, and censorship towards connection, communication, and compassion. The Phoenix Generation's impact will begin to be felt in 2030, but there is much to do to prepare for their arrival. The Phoenix Generation will work toward forming a planetary society, a transition more radical than the shift from agrarian to urban life during the Industrial Revolution. These children are being born with increased instinctive intelligence and with a greater degree of inherited wisdom. With them, the quantum revolution begun 100 years ago will become mainstream. This will bring about a shift away from external dependencies in the realms of politics, economics, health, education, and many more. This normalizing of new perspectives, cosmic awareness, and of multidimensional realities will usher in a great wave of change. The Phoenix Generation is a deeply positive exploration of our collective future. Hello and welcome, Kingsley, and thank you so much for joining us again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thanks, Greg. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Today, Kingsley, we're going to talk about your brand new book, which is entitled The Phoenix Generation: A New Era of Connection, Compassion, and Consciousness. Before we dive into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your background and then just give us a quick overview of the concept behind the book.
Yeah, sure. Well, my background is based in sociology, mainly. I mean, I worked overseas for a number of years as a teacher in English and American literature. And this was in the years around 96 to 2003 when I was working overseas. And at that time, I noticed that the world was changing in incredible ways, mainly because of globalization. And I was brushing up on my Chomsky and Naomi Klein and looking at how things were changing. And especially, I say, I was overseas in Turkey in that area, which was seeing a lot of interventions from globalization. So what happened is that I decided to make a turnaround and stop teaching dead white writers, which was generally what I was teaching, and go into sociology. So I studied, I went back to the UK and I took a doctorate in sociology, and I ended up being a lecturer and seminar teacher for several years at Lancaster University in the north of England, the northwest. And over the years, I studied not only globalization, but global communications and technologies, which is quite important in the work that I do today. And I left the university after publishing with my professor colleague a book called After the Car, which was looking at the global futures in terms of not just the car, but how everything combined with energy, technologies, urban living, etc. So that got me interested in global events. But I've been interested from day one in also how human consciousness intervenes in our social life, or how they converge social behavior with consciousness. And so I took that further in my own work, let's say freelance work. The book that I published after that and was my first solo effort was called New Consciousness for a New World. So from that title, you can see where I was going. And so over the years, I've been exploring this convergence of global behavior with individualized attitudes, and how both individual and let's say, collective consciousness is a part of this transition. And so then a couple of years ago, I co-wrote a book with Irvin Laszlo called The Dawn of the Akashic Age. And this theme of the Phoenix Generation, I first came up when I was doing work for that. And I was seeing how looking towards the future, we have to look at the next generation, which is going to come in. And how are they going to, let's say, take the baton and run with it from our generation? Because our generation have been dealing with a lot of transition, which we've been seeing so much now in the last few years with the deterioration of a lot of global and social systems, a lot of old paradigm thinking, which is just not working anymore in the world. You can see that in many systems, such as economics, technologies and education, in media and politics, in health. All these systems are really, you know, by, you know, over there, out of date timing. So all this together, I started looking at this aspect and combining all my ideas of the last few years to really look at the transition, not what's happening now so much, but what's happening really as we're moving into passing the baton on to the new generation, which is coming in now and will come of age in the next 10, 15 years, let's say, can be teenagers in 2030. So that's basically what brought me here in a nutshell, Greg.
Well, at this stage, I just want to say something about the Indigo Children, which is something that you refer to in the book. It's an idea that came up many decades ago, and this has been widely sort of debunked and criticized as sort of New Age pseudoscience. And basically, if people don't know what this is, it's a concept of, so, actually, along the lines of what you're talking about, with, you know, an emergent generation with a modified consciousness, a different way of being than had come before. And this has been criticized because it's been seen as like an excuse for some disappointed parents of autistic children to think that their children are special and not give them their medication. Basically, what we're talking about includes this, but we're not exclusively talking about this. This isn't a conversation about this decades-old concept per se.
No, you're right to bring that up, and I'm also critical of it, and for several reasons. I think one of the main reasons is that having this tag, the Indigo Children, was stigmatizing the children. Now, you mentioned they're having a kind of a new generation having a modified consciousness. Well, in fact, that's normal. That's what happens in every generation. I mean, our generation, Greg, have a different consciousness than our parents, and likewise from our grandparents. So, you know, if we were in a conversation with our grandparents, you know, we wouldn't be able to talk about our subconscious or our, you know, our Freudian slips or our id, because our grandparents don't have that vocabulary, they don't have those concepts, because they don't have that inner world which has been brought up in the last 50 years or so, especially with the rise of psychologies and transcendental psychology, and especially the widespread knowledge of psychiatric terms and that. So you see, we all have a modified consciousness, so that's not anything new or strange. And where I'm coming from is that, and I talk about it heavily in my work, is that I'm not talking about the new age, I'm talking about the new normal. So I work toward demystifying and not trying to make things esoteric or hidden or some way new agey. So now, the origins of the Indigo Children actually is because the lady who first termed them had this sensory, we call it disease or infirmity. I don't think disease is the right word, but the sensory condition whereby she could actually see colors that were, let's say, instead of other senses. So therefore, her eyes were picking up colors where the colors were representing an energy of the body. So when she saw a lot of the young children having this indigo haze around them, it wasn't because they were walking around with auras or their whatever the energy matrix is. It was just that her sensory condition were picking up on energy and putting a color to it. And so what she was saying was that there's a different energy connected with a lot of the new births coming into the world, which again is quite rightly so, because there is different energy conditions at different epochs in the Earth's history. So this got picked up by saying that the children were star children or crystal children, and a lot of the new age crowd ring around saying that these are going to be the new let's say a new generation with special abilities, like telekinetic abilities and a lot of PS abilities, which stigmatized the children straight away and created this idea that they were a minority new age. Now, I'm not saying that at all. I think that there were an initial wave of young children coming in who were thinking differently and were reacting in ways differently against the incumbent systems, such as educational systems, and they were finding it very difficult to adjust. And so they were then automatically put into the indigo category, which was not beneficial for them either. I mean, trying to adjust to a society which you may not fully understand, and then you're being told that you're indigo and you have no idea why. So I think, although I have to realize that I put a label onto them called the Phoenix Generation, I'm very loose with the label, and I'm just saying that there's going to be the generation coming in are going to be more having different thinking patterns. I think that's a part of modified consciousness, different thinking patterns, and so they will respond to systems differently, and that's what I explained throughout the book, Greg.
We can see, you've alluded to this in the introduction, that we're facing tremendous problems on a global basis now. Collapse of systems and multiple fronts. It seems really that the industrial model has run its course and it's just in its early stages of its death throes now. One of the things that you're anticipating will be different about how people think about these issues is that solutions to our problems are more likely to emerge from the periphery rather than being met head on, as it were. I mean, we see some of the problems when we meet these problems head on. For example, the Occupy movement, how that ended up, globalization protests, like in Seattle and lots of other cities around the world over the years. That's not ended well for either side, really. We have the Bilderberg meetings going on. That's now entered public consciousness. When those get protested, it's very much a sort of lose-lose situation. And really, it's about sort of almost winning by not playing the game. Going forward, it's about just bypassing all this stuff.
Yeah, you're exactly right there, Greg. And what you pointed at is a normal response. It's what you may call the kind of the early adopter response or the early wave response, is that when we see that the systems are not working, but not only that they are entirely unjust and inequitable, and they are detrimental to human growth and well-being. Well, I think the natural response is, as you've rightly said, is a kind of a protest against this injustice, and to fight it head on, because it makes us feel such an emotional response to realize that we're being played for and manipulated against our interests. And so the first wave adopters are these protests, are these very public gatherings. Which does highlight the issue, which is a benefit, so it comes into the public consciousness, but they're detrimental to the fact that they also can put us in a bad light, because the protesters get shown as being anti-society, anti-civil, and disobedient, and then it gives the incumbent powers more authority to rally against us, and it's just bad PR, let's face it. But that's a first wave response. And then when we what we realize that is that in all patterns throughout history, real change does come from the periphery. If you try to fight it from the center, then that's when you have this clash, this head-on conflict, and it doesn't really create a solution. It just aggravates the issue. But I say real change begins like an anomaly. It often appears on the periphery, and sometimes the core powers don't take much notice of it because they think it doesn't have much power to really damage their status quo. But yet, often these peripheral emergencies are known as disruptive or disruptive events or disruptive technologies, or and what they do is that they play into the system through ripples, and then they actually can then really exponentially grow, and they just really take over the a lot of these out of date systems. And so what's happening is that I think, like we say, the generation we're in now, and the younger of our generation, perhaps like our you and myself, we are aware of this, and we're aware that we have to play around the system and create something which just basically tries to create new models that just replaces your models rather than fighting them. Now we have this awareness. Imagine now the next generation to come along, which are going to be born, I think, really just not even understanding why these detrimental systems are in place, and not wanting really to even engage with them head on, and just wanting to really get on and do things the wrong way to make change. So there's a difference there. We're moving from protest into dialogue, from dialogue into action, and they just want to go and get on and do it. And that really is when we start to see change at a much faster rate, when people are just doing things that really evades the old systems and will replace them, rather than wasting time and energy trying to debate or protest against those incumbent systems.
Yeah, in the book you refer to this idea of a bridge generation, that is to say people who are alive now, who are beginning to become aware of some of these changes we've been talking about. And I don't know if you're aware of the work of Dolores Cannon, but she wrote a book called Three Waves of Volunteers in New Earth, and she talks about a similar thing about subsequent generations of people. Initially, they're sort of aware that there's perhaps something they're supposed to be doing, and then there's another generation who have got a more keen sense of something, and have a calling, perhaps. And then you eventually get a generation who are completely aware, and they are, what I suppose, what you would describe as the Phoenix generation, these people who are having this modified consciousness to the extent that they are, you know, fully bypassing the old paradigm.
Yeah, well, I've heard of the name Dolores Cannon, but I'm not aware of that particular work. But I think this is a good thing. In fact, when I sent off, I asked another writer, PMH Atwater, to write a review of the book, and she's written about a new generation of children. And she wrote back and said, you've written more or less exactly what I've written, but you haven't even referenced my book. And I said, I'm sorry, I didn't know you had a book on this subject. So it seems like there is other people out there, which I think is a good thing, because it means we're tapping into a similar intuition, a similar sense. And we're all picking up on this, which it does, for my mind, it doesn't mean we're copying at all. It means we're validating something which is in the air or in the ethers. And there's different names for it, so I don't think the names are that important either. I think, as you say, it's a concept. And for me, I've, as a sociologist as well, I always see change not only through the small picture, the micro scale, but on the macro scale as well. And I see real change is that which unfolds organically, and it takes time. So although there was a huge tipping point really around late 2008, when we had the first major financial crisis, then we had the tipping point of so-called December 2012. At those places, people were expecting huge change very quickly, and it didn't really happen, because real lasting change, for me, takes time and takes generational time. And that's why I do look at what the generation coming in. So what the way I termed our generation the bridge generation, because, and I wanted to point out that although there's a lot of things you know, going to pot in the world, and it may look like it's despairing, we should not despair or take a negative stance on this, because the fact that there are actually a lot of systems that are showing their inadequacies and some are breaking up, is a good sign that it's showing us that they're no longer relevant for the age that we need. And so, but we need to, we're in a stage of the British generation whereby we have to deal with this and have one foot in the old world to actually stabilize our lives and the lives of those around us, and to deal the best way we can, which is what's going on, and to have what I feel is a balanced perspective on the changes happening. And so, in other words, to be able to have the information and the awareness to make the right choices and to make the right priorities, whether those priorities means changing our career path, changing our lifestyle, changing our relationship to certain systems such as finances and politics and health, to be able to deal with those changes with a positive and constructive mindset. I think that's important for the British generation. That's why I framed quite a few, quite a space in the book to frame this. So saying, look, I understand where we are now. And then having that balanced understanding, we can then, like in a relay race, pass on the baton to those coming in. So they don't come into a blank slate. They're coming to at least, there's a number of us who are aware, have tried to lay the groundwork and saying, well, now you take over and we can have a conversation with you because we understand you and we understand that you may not understand some of the crazy stuff that's going on in our world. So I think it's not only recognizing the Phoenix generation, it's recognizing ourselves, Greg. And that's why in the very prologue of the book, I think in the very first sentence, I actually state maybe those of the Phoenix generation will not be reading this book at all, because although the book's about them, the book really is for us, because we need to get to grips with it.
You can see some of the things that are beginning to be established, alternative ways of doing things, new technology, some of which, when they prove to be a bit too successful, one thing we have to deal with, of course, is the authorities cracking down on these things. I'm thinking of whether it be something from Bitcoin through to people trying to grow their own food, become self-sustaining in that way. And suddenly this legislation comes along and people try to sort of stop the development. But it's playing whack-a-mole, really, because it's not Bitcoin is a thing, for example, but the real idea is a decentralized virtual currency, and that's an idea, and you can't kill that, if you see what I mean. And you can't kill people's desire or ability to be able to grow their own food, for example. You can bring in zoning laws, you can fine people for growing cabbages in their front garden if you want, but that's not going to do the job.
That's right, and as a well-known phrase says, you can't kill the idea whose time has come, or something like that. And it's right, because these are again the early wave, the early adopters. So it's not about Bitcoin, but it's about, like you say, decentralized distributed economies, which will be a combination of digital currencies and micro currencies and localized currencies. And so these are the early signs. And you say, it is a kind of whack-a-mole. Get, the first heads that pop up, you whack them down. But when they start popping up everywhere in all walks of life, and not only in the industrialized Western world, then these really are going to start becoming the new models. And when I say not only the Western world, that's a quite a crucial point, because in the next few in the upcoming years, there's going to be a huge wave of first-time adopters of technology in what we refer to as developing countries. Now, I mean, just this week, there's been a new £60 smartphone being released, Android-based by Google in India, so it's affordable to a much wider class of people. There is Wi-Fi coverage being put into a lot of areas, so a lot of these areas are going to leapfrog the Industrial Revolution, and not going to be putting down cables. They're going to be going straight from agricultural land to Wi-Fi land, and so the internet broadband is going to be adopted in those countries in the next decade at a phenomenal rate. And it's been predicted that because of the huge number of people over in those countries, there's going to be up to 3 billion new people coming online in the next 10 years. Because so far, all the adopters really of the internet have been mostly in technologized countries, and of course technologized countries in Middle Eastern territories also. So it's not, that kind of geographically spread. So, but also these new voices coming online will be people with great need and a great need to have innovative solutions to their situations. And so when you have these people of great need and great young minds coming online and hooking up to the global conversation and being able to network into decentralized projects, decentralized conversations, forums, then I think we're going to see really is a great wave of disruptive innovation, disruptive thinking coming into play. And I think that is really where we're going to see a lot of these emerging periphery ideas, which could be, like you say, digitized economies. There could be new educational platforms, which is coming quite strongly in agricultural areas, and new systems of health, I think there's a maybe an assumption that the Phoenix Generation is just naturally the generation of people in the Western world because we're accustomed to associating with them. But no, I think a large majority of the Phoenix Generation, Greg, are going to be coming in from those areas which perhaps have not had such a strong voice before because they've not had the platform for those voices. And we saw the early adopters through the Arab Spring and those being the young tech-savvy voices. But, you know, putting a lot of the African nations and a lot of other South Asian countries and the Asian and the Indian rural poor, these are going to be a part of the Phoenix Generation. And we think we're going to have a lot coming our way to see, Greg.
It was almost 20 years to the day when I first got on the internet. I'd be interested to hear about when you did. And it's come such a long way since then. It's almost been the ultimate disruptive technology. It has facilitated so many things in the advancement, I think, of collective consciousness. We're told that the most prolific thing on the internet is pornography. I'd like to think that's not the case. But anyway, there's so much garbage out there. I think that's really, it is the global brain. It's a reflection of everything that humanity is, good and bad. And I'm very keenly aware when anything comes up that looks like restricting the internet and policing it. But also there's a bit of a double bind here for the powers that would be, because the internet is sort of essential to the world economy now, and yet it's facilitating so much of the new ideas that we're discussing.
Yes, and this is the double-edged sword of technology, which we can't really dismiss either way. We can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And interestingly enough, I got my first accredited internet account 16 years ago, and I was in Turkey then. And the reason I got it, not only because of the new ideas of this internet thing, what spurred me, in fact, I was traveling through Egypt, and I was traveling on a felucca, a little boat on the Nile, with a group of other travelers, and we got to know each other, and we wanted to swap contact details. And one of the travelers said, "Oh, here's my email," and I said, "Well, what's that?" And when he told me, I thought, wow, I've got to get an email. So, you know, 16, you know, there it goes. So 16 years ago, I got my first email account, and the traveler was from the US. And so, and I've been online ever since in SA. And so, rightly so. And the internet is a phenomenon. It has changed the face of global behavior, global communication, global connection, and the way that our global systems have worked like nothing before. And really, you know, I think Tim Berners-Lee only put out the World Wide Web something around 94, around that time. So, you know, so think really, and as you rightly said, it's only been about 20 years since really, you know, the internet's been up and running as an open platform. Obviously, you know, many years before that, it was a kind of a university research, and then DARPA. We know the history. But as a public platform, about 20 years, and look at the change that's happened, Greg, in that time, and especially really in the last decade, when I think it's really gone global. The change is just phenomenal. And in the early days, people mentioned it about the global brain, and even that now, that metaphor is old hat. People have gone beyond that. And it's not only is it a phenomenon, it's a phenomenon which we don't yet fully comprehend, and we don't know where it's going to take us and where we can go with it, or what change is really going to bring in by it. And that's why the authorities are so worried, because they cannot regulate it. They're trying to, but you see, it's this kind of Pandora's box. It's really out there now, and it's almost a self-evolving entity. And they know it's changing all the systems, everything we said, through financial, through educational, through health, through politics. It's going to go through all these systems and bring change. And so what they're trying to do is trying to jump on it and try to get their foot in the door and be able to control it, or as they used to call it, the Obama off button. You know, they really want to do that. But you see, the internet came about in our, let's say, our generation, or our lifetime, Greg. But what's going to be quite significant is that the Phoenix generation, or the generation coming in, they're going to be born into a world where it's already there. And so they're going to be really accustomed to it almost immediately. And so they won't have this learning curve that we've had to try to adjust to it. And so when you have that correspondence with technology at a much more instinctual level, combined with the exponential development of that technology at the same time, then that's when you're going to see, I think, quite exponential radical change, Greg.
Well, in terms of systems breaking down, I believe I'm not my mobile phone's probably about 10 years old, so I'm not a great follower of the latest gadgets and the cutting edge of technology. But I think there's a new iPhone out recently or something along those lines. A great deal of talk about, you know, oh, I've got to get the new phone as soon as it arrives. And I see you'll have seen presumably some of this footage online of the disgusting spectacle that is Black Friday in America, which is consumerism run rampant and people occasionally trampled to death for the want of, you know, cheap gadgets. But for me, this is as distressing as it is to watch people still wrapped up in, I know that's an extreme example of consumerism, but still wrapped up in things. For me, it smells like the end of something. Yes, we have to go through it and it's not easy, but it tells me anyway, it indicates to me that this is something that's coming to an end and it's just having one last desperate gasp. And that increasingly, I definitely see this with younger people. They may talk about what they want to get out of life in terms of things, but when you ask them about what they've enjoyed recently, they almost invariably talk more about people and experiences. And for me, that's really what life is about.
True, yeah. And again, this is a phenomenon of early contact with such technologies. So, you know, we're seeing a shift, and I speculate we're going to see a shift from hardware to content. And we're already seeing that now. So as you rightly said, the early consumerist days, it was just mad consumerism just to possess. It was about possession. And once they got it in their hands, people just looked at this object and just drooled over it, didn't actually do much with it, apart from show it off to their friends, you see. And now we have this kind of halfway house where people line up in crazy queues to get the first, as you said, the new iPhone 6. So that's a part of consumerism. But once they've got it in their hands, they then start to do something with the applications. Or many of them do. So it's kind of half-half. There's some consumerism, and then they do something with the actual object, and they work with content. Now, the other side of it is, I mentioned the new phones going into the like India and developing nations, and their phones like for £65, their smartphones, and also like the laptop for $100, which was another project to get the technology out there. The hardware is really an issue. People aren't going to so much drool over a $100 laptop, which is nothing special. It's very basic. But what they will drool over is the access that this object gives them to a world of connection, communication, and online capacity and ability. And so we're moving into a world of content. And that's why I think, you know, the price of hardware has dropped over the years, because the swing is towards producing content and software. And so this is the, you know, the so-called cloud phenomenon. So we're moving into an age of whatever people have dubbed it, the kind of the ephemeralization, that we're moving from things we can touch to things that we actually are not really there, their content, their ideas, their innovation, we work with it. And so I think that's going to be the meaningful thing, where consumerism is going to be taking over with the ability to actually do something productive. So another example, Greg, before I finish, the technologies gave us, we were consumers of media. And so, for example, the radio was the first example, then television. And we used to sit in front of the television, and we were just passive one-way consumers. We just had sat there with our mouths and our eyes open, and we just lapped it all up. But now we can produce content. This is exactly what you're doing with your radio station, and what many people out there are doing. They're creating their own media platforms. So they're not just consumers, they're prosumers. They're producing the content more and more. And that, as I talk about in the book, is going to really see, is really going to take on the media giants. We're going to see a decentralization of media. More and more individuals and more of the new generation are going to be the journalists producing the content. Because many areas, mainstream journalists either can't get there or won't want to get there. And people on the ground are going to be producing the content. And that is part of the shift away from consumerism, by being the producers. And that gives a lot of empowerment in the hands of individuals, Greg.
Yeah, it's interesting when it comes to the world of mainstream journalism, how people like myself, for example, would struggle to get accreditation to be in a press conference, for example, given by the Prime Minister. It just wouldn't happen because, well, you're not a serious journalist. You're not a member of a union or an organisation or whatever. And it increasingly seems to me that when you get the likes of Obama getting up and making a speech and then taking questions, it's all so controlled. And if you, they never do this, but you imagine panning the camera around that room, and it's really the establishment sort of talking to itself and then feeding that out, you know, to be absorbed by the rest of us, you know, if we choose to.
Yes, and it's so contrived. And, you know, of course, if any of those so-called elected special journalist guests ever asked a question that really rubbed up the wrong way, you can be sure they wouldn't be invited back again. And so you have to play the game if you want to get access. And that's what's all been about, the old systems. You have to play the game if you want to be a part of it. Well, now the gameplay is changing, the rules are changing, and the playing field is changing. And what's happening is that a lot of people now, they're not so gullible anymore. They can see through the charade. You know, they can see through, you know, the emperor's clothes, so to speak, and they're not interested in listening to this newspeak from this manufactured artificial news environment, you know. And that's why a lot of people now are turning to alternative media, or what's being called alternative media. And the demand for news from these other outlets has increased tremendously over the years. So, in fact, people themselves are giving validation to the other media outlets. And the mainstream media has witnessed this, which is why some of the big players have been trying to buy up other online media outlets, because, you know, they're losing not only their readership, but they're losing their credibility. And so that's what's going to happen, because really, if we take away our interest, i.e. take back our power from these mainstream systems, then that's when they start to get worried, because, you know, their system is based on revenue, it's based on advertisers, and if their readership goes down, then so does their business model, which is the best thing we can do, is take away our attention from those systems. And so, you know, it doesn't bother me if you or people like you don't have this accreditation from the you know, mainstream media. In fact, it's probably a plus sign. I'd be worried if you had accreditation from the Prime Minister, Craig.
Yes, quite.
So people are going to, I think you're going to get validation from people walking to your, you know, people validate with their feet. You know, that's what they say, voters vote with their feet. And so when these news sites get more people listen to them, more people participating, because now the decentralized news is more participatory. People send in their news. There's a communication. It's not just a consuming of news, and that's all what I talk about as part of the new generation are going to be involved in that and producing it, and that really is going to take the attention away from the core to the periphery, and that's where the periphery then will start to create its new, the new models, the new thinking, the new paradigm, Greg.
Me doing something like this kind of in my spare time is because I feel I have to do it. It's not nothing to do with money. However, I will just throw this out there. If everybody on YouTube alone, not even legalizefreedom.com, if everybody who viewed or listened on YouTube alone gave me one penny each time they did that, I would have at least £35,000 a year, and that is called a living. So the numbers of a lot of the alternative media do add up. It's just that a lot of the established media is, for the BBC, the classic example, is heavily subsidized. But people are increasingly voting not just with their feet, but with their wallets as well. And you can certainly see some alternative organizations like Alex Jones over in America, for example. Love the guy or hate the guy, he's made a success of that, and he now employs about 50 people. So that's, is that alternative media anymore? Well, I think it probably is, but the point is it's financially viable. And, you know, we're going to see that increasingly, I think, in future.
Yeah, these are the new economic models, and what you picked up on is so true, and that's why a lot of people now, let's say people who want to, artists or want to go out there and pass something on, that they're doing it from themselves. They're doing it whether it's through self-publishing or self-recording or self-media platforms. Now, it's interesting because that decentralized economic model has already been, I say, the first wave. We can see that in what's known as crowdfunding. And there's now some major sites coming out. And there's been some huge projects out there, not just smaller ones, but technological innovation. So what this means is that someone who has an idea, whether it's an idea for a business model, a product, or content, doesn't need subsidizing or doesn't need to sell their patent to a large corporation. You know, they're not under the influence or the need for that. They can put a crowdfunding proposal out and say, look, if I can get this money, I can fund my own projects and I'll give it back to you, i.e. I'll give you the first album, the first DVD of the film, or you'll get the first, receive the first product, you know. And that now is the model which is going to start taking off more and more. And as you say, if you people out there saying, if you can give 1p for every time, you know, you get something from me which you like, we can have a mutual win-win model whereby I can live and I can give you content which is not subsidized or influenced by any outside powers. I control the content and I give it to you as it is. And so that bypasses your model. It goes straight from producer to recipient. And that's important because most of the power brokers, they sit in the middle and they control this patch of distribution, whether it's energy distribution, financial distribution, educational distribution. You know, they can't control who's receiving it so much. They control the middle ground. And if we can bypass that through new decentralized models, which have been on show by crowdfunding, and I think there's going to be a lot more new adopters and take the crowdfunding model to a new stage, then we're going to see a lot of these a kind of growth in this area, and that will kick on to other areas. So these new decentralized platforms such as crowdfunding will then spur a growth in digital currency, such as Bitcoin was the major early adopter of that, and other digital currencies are going to come on online, whereby people then can financially have an arrangement between themselves, which then doesn't have to be monitored through, again, a brokerage, which is important as well, Greg.
Just to take a slightly different direction, I've often speculated as to whether human evolution is now an inner process. Maybe, I mean, of course, we live such short spans compared to, you know, time overall, and it's very difficult to observe evolutionary effects on ourselves, because, you know, just because for that very reason. But if evolution is inner, this could perhaps tie into exactly what you're talking about with the evolution of our consciousness and into what you call an integral consciousness, that is to say, not a separateness and isolation, but more holistic. And you also touch upon in the book, and this overlaps with this, the idea of neuroplasticity. And there's lots of good science now that actually shows how our brains can physically change over the course of time, and not just when we're growing as well, but, you know, at any stage of our lives. And I've had Dr. Bruce Lipton on here, for example, and his work documents many of the actual mechanisms of physical change. So this is some very exciting possibilities here to consider.
Oh, there's so many possibilities. And what's good for us is that now a lot of these new information and new knowledge is coming up where we can tie the dots together. So rather than just speculating, we can say, look, actually, you know, this can be verified. And Bruce Lipton's work is important. And if you ever get the chance, Greg, I would recommend inviting Daniel Siegel to talk with him. And his work on neuroplasticity and his work on mindsight is very revealing. And so, you know, this is not new, because, you know, neurons that, you know, fire together, wire together, as they say. So if we learn a new trade, a new skill, then we actually do rewire neurons to fix in that new set of let's say brain capacity. So there's nothing new in that, but if we then are really empathy also is a new way of having, you know, our neurons firing in relation to another person or people around the world. So we have this, we talk of global empathy, whereby we can connect with people, because when we see events across the world, our neurons mirror that situation, and we have a similar response in our own brains. So what's also going to be significant is also the understanding in terms of science and the quantum science, which I deal with quite a lot in the book, because the quantum science is going to be a main driver in different areas. One of them will be understanding science and the fact that we are living in a universe with quantum effects, thereby everything is in instantaneous connection in a non-local field. But also quantum biology, which is showing us already that our body is in a quantum field, and that our cells and our DNA give off biophotons, which creates an instantaneous field of information. So we are in touch with our body and informational field instantaneously. Now, I feel that one of the major drivers in the future in terms of technology will be quantum technology. And already there've been a lot of developments and strides forward in that. You know, in terms of, you know, quantum encryption is taking that to a new level as well. And when you get the quantum computing, whereby you don't have to be either one or zero, binary state, you can be the in-between state, then computing is going to be on exponential path of development. What these all show us, Greg, is that, in fact, our science, our biology, our computers are going to show us to an undeniable degree that we are connected instantaneously in ways we've never comprehended before. And when that actually clicks, when that actually sinks in, I mean, we talk about this, we say, yeah, and I understand it, I've heard about that, but we haven't really clicked it. And when it does click, then we'll understand that that's going to be a real paradigm changer. That really is going to affect how we perceive really the whole, you know, the world and global affairs and our relations and our capacity to be effective in the world. Thereby, as individuals, we can make change in the world, because what do we do individually in our local environments with the people around us? It does have an effect in the world because we're all connected. Now, when the young children are being born into a world with that understanding, then I think they're going to take that and put it into practice. And a final thing, Greg, is that what I talk about in the book is that I sense that a thing very, very significant is that the Phoenix generation are going to be born with an increased instinctual knowledge base. So whereby they will not need to rely on acquired knowledge, whereby we go to school and we're told that this is knowledge. We acquire it, which is a form of conditioning. And we are conditioned according to the norms of our era, which are basically way out of date. Instinctual knowledge is a form of gnosis. And a lot of young children now are exhibiting this, that they understand things inside of themselves, in the inner realm, as you say. And this inner faith, inner understanding, inner knowledge base, when you converge that with a world which can connect with that instinctual understanding, then again, that is going to take things forward on an exponential degree.
Well, we could say, I suppose, that learning begins when education ends in some way. I mean, I know certainly a lot of the stuff that I was spoon-fed at school, well, perhaps all of it has been thrown out, apart from perhaps the ability to order drinks in French and German. But to be honest, that wasn't a deal-breaker. I don't think it was worth, 16 years of my life for that. But talking about the quantum physics and what that tells us, or is increasingly telling us about reality, and that's everything from our own brains right up to the cosmic level, is kind of also leading to another form of broadening awareness, which is on a cosmic level. And it might sound a bit sort of out there, but I think it's important. One of the things I think that's led us down many blind alleys has been this idea of just this little third stone from the sun, and here we are in a corner of the galaxy and we're alone. Whether you think there's anything to the idea of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe or not, it seems that we're part of this colossal intelligent system. Really, that's how I see it. And imagining that everything down here on Earth is all there is and it's all that matters, I don't think it serves us very well. It hasn't so far, anyway.
That's right. I mean, that thinking that we are something like we're a 3 billion year accident, living on a dead rock, hurtling through a vacuum of dead space. I don't think it wings it anymore, that type of thinking. Even the idea of the Big Bang, a lot of scientists are questioning that now and coming up with ideas beyond that. And even now, when the major paradigm for most people is that we live in this one universe, which was, like I say, just a result of the Big Bang, most major scientists, they don't follow that either. And they say the new model is that there have been multiverses, and that multiple Big Bangs, and each universe, kind of learns from a previous universe and carries on the informational field. And so there are many universes that have been in existence, and this is just one of them. And it may be, let's say, the last one of the Big Bangs, or it may exist in parallel with other universes. So most credible scientists now are talking about multiverses and not universe. So that is a big step forward. And so, if you look at that, even that shift in consensus science in the last decade, that's a huge leap. And when you look, if we spoke to our parents even, and said in their heyday that in the future people are going to be like communicating like on Star Trek through these, the little kind of video machines, and they're going to be connecting around the world and having video conversations. It looked like magic to them, and they were going to say, yeah, maybe, if I'll believe it when I see it kind of attitude. And so, we have that kind of attitude with the future of what's going to come down the line, is I believe it when I see it. We're an incredibly sarcastic species, Greg. Any future technology, as Arthur C. Clarke said, one of his laws was any future technology will appear as magic. I'm paraphrased that in very badly, but I think you understand what I'm saying. And that's the case, that it's so beyond our comprehension that it's going to seem like magic to our thinking today. But, when we, every generation is, when they emerge into a world with new patterns of understanding and a consciousness which connects with the technology around them in a way which we've not been able to in such an instinctual way, then it won't seem like magic. It will seem like taking the utilities that we have and taking them forward. But more than that, not just technology, there's going to be an understanding that environmental systems are not working in the way that we are trying to control them. Our understanding of the cosmos, of being a dead cosmos, is just crazy. It's not in line with an intelligent relationship with the world around us. The idea of multiverses, the idea of multidimensions, as I mentioned in the book, the last chapters talks about normalizing the multiverse. That the concept of a multiverse will not be strange to those of the new generation. It'll be more normal to them. So when you have these new perceptions, then to us it's a new consciousness. To them, it's a normal instinctual consciousness which combines the inner understanding and inner normality with what is emerging in the external world. And I think so there's going to be a convergence of different areas, Greg. There's going to be a convergence of inner gnosis and what for want of a better word is inner spirituality, inner gnosis with external technologies, external awareness and perceptions of social systems, and a kind of global empathy that we need to start working towards a planetary society which is unified but diverse and equitable. And you know, young generations don't want war, they want peace, they want to connect, they don't want conflict. Conflict and control and competition are the old energies, the old patterns of thinking. And what I talk about in the book, and I don't think I've been overly optimistic, I don't call myself a Pollyanna. I think when you look at all these changes in a perspective of generational change, then I think we can see values of connection, compassion, consciousness, and collaboration going to be values that will be more normalized in the years to come.
Well, just something you said there about older generations and technology reminded me of in the late 1980s, my grandfather, we rented for him a VHS video player because back then they were so expensive, most people rented them. And he was really into Westerns, but he was reliant, obviously, on when they would show up on TV. So I told him that we'd get this machine that we could then not only record Westerns from the television, but we could buy ready prepared video cassettes with Westerns on them, and he could watch them anytime he wanted. I could see on his face he couldn't get his head around it. I think it took him about a week or two to actually fathom that this could be real. And it seems absurd to us, but I suppose in the early days people thought that moving pictures themselves were magic. People went along to the cinema, didn't they, and just couldn't believe what they were seeing.
That's right. And I've had a recent conversation with an older member of my family, and I tried to explain the cloud. And I don't mean the clouds in the sky. You know, it was like, where's information? It's on your computer. I said, no, it's on the cloud. But, you know, if you go into my computer, you can't get it. No, it's in the cloud. I can. And they couldn't get their head around that it's in the cloud. I said, where's the cloud? And I threw my arms around. It's everywhere. Where's everywhere? And so,
yes.
You know, it's, you know, we have to, you know, we have to be patient with them, because I'm sure that the next generation are going to have a similar concept and say to us something, and we're going to say, but how does that work? And so, you know, so that's normal. I think what I'm trying to get at in the book is that we're coming to a point, a kind of almost a tipping point, where things are going to move along at a much more radical speed. And so when you tie in quantum computing with, let's say, the knowledge of quantum biology, with the understanding of the DNA and the energetic capacity of the DNA, such as Bruce Lipton's talked about, and how the DNA affects our quantum informational field, that'll have impacts in health and people's individual understanding of health. We're going to have effects in, we've talked about already, we've touched upon economics, we've touched upon distributed communities and technologies and communications. We have participatory politics, whereby politics, then people have more say through, again, the ways that they can collaborate. And we're seeing that now in referendums, and people communicating and having their more of a voice, such as in the Scottish referendum. We saw it in the Arab Spring, how that created a wave of revolt and radical change. When that comes in, and it all comes in around a similar epoch, Greg, and it comes in with a generation who are going to be less worried and have less fear, because as we talked about at the beginning of our conversation, indigo children, they were less numbers, they were had less empowerment, and they were stuck in these systems which ostracized them or stigmatized them or basically drugged them, you know, and they didn't have the power to react. But when you have a great majority of the younger people, and they're going to let's say create the change within these systems rather than being stifled by them, then that's when you have a tipping point and change can occur on a much grander scale in a much smaller time frame in ways that we perhaps can't foresee, which is good because the change is going to show us where it's taking us.
Well, in terms of a tipping point, there's an important point you make in the book, actually, is that we do not need a numerical majority of people adopting something for it to become the norm. It can be something like 10% in a society can adopt something, and then it spreads to everyone else as a result. So that's encouraging. The idea, it's easy to look, you know, turn on the television and look at the news and despair at and I don't know, go out and have conversations with people and struggle to find anyone who you're on the same page with. But we don't need that other 90%. They'll be dragged along in the wake of it when it happens.
That's right, and maybe even less than 10%. But and you say it's difficult more difficult for our generation to find like-minded people. I think it's been much, much easier in the last few years. We can actually have conversation with people like we're having now, and they get it. I think there's an energy of getting it more now. When people understand it. So there's a wave of awareness which is spreading, in a very strong way by the global communications. So when we combine those things, we're going to see a change in such an incredible time. So I'm not being this kind of unrealistic person by saying all these great positive changes are going to come, or you know we're all going to be, you know, energetically moving on to another higher consciousness and everything's going to be fine. Now, what I'm saying is not about that. I'm saying that this change is generational, but when you have so many factors coming together at this time, especially when we have a new generation being born into a world when the technology is at a level which they are adapting to almost automatically and from their first days, and combined with what I speculate will be an increased intuitive awareness of how to use those technologies, and also an awareness that the systems don't work and are dysfunctional, and they want to make action and create change. When all those happen together, then you have an incredible convergence for change. And that time is going to be in the upcoming years, in the next couple of decades. So that's what I'm looking at, and that's why I see it as a critical time, Greg.
Well, just in closing, Kingsley, I think when we consider, you know, that sort of old paradigm of us existing in a dead, meaningless universe and where everything goes and nothing matters, and so we might as well have it now because we're going to die soon and forever. It can be frustrating going through this time when we are seeing the unfolding of these changes, but I suppose we have to remind ourselves, or I certainly do anyway, that in the grand scheme of things, it's just my life, it's just your life, it's not very long at all. And whether this is the only reality we ever experience as individuals, and there aren't, you know, multiple lives in multiple universes, that we have a role to play, and that this is our time, and that it might be nice to project ourselves off into a future where things have changed for the better, but that's not where we are, and we all have a role to play whether we're aware of it or not, and we have to do it here and now.
I'd agree with you 100%, is that change is the one permanent, I think, feature of life. It's always in flux. It's always in change. Is that often we don't perceive it, or we're not aware of it because we've led or we live more static lives, or we live more regular lives. But change is the one factor which underlies living systems. It underlies life in the universe. It underlies especially life on this planet. And we can put meaning into that. And I think this is a great thing, is that this is an amazing time to be alive because so much is happening. And it's our choice how we want to make meaning from that and how we want to participate. There's no right or wrong. There's no degree of participation. There's no, we have to do 80% of this, or we have to do as much as this. No. Everything. You know, this world is so connected. Everything we do, whether it's just doing small acts of kindness or being with our family, it can all be a part of it. But the incredible thing to realize is that, you know, our descendants are going to look back at this time and realize that it was a time of incredible opportunity. And maybe they'll wish that they would be a part of it. Well, we are a part of it. And I think having an appreciation of that and making and creating meaning for ourselves in that and not have fear of change or not having fear to do things which we haven't yet done. We need to step forward and make our lives as meaningful, rich as possible for the short time we're here and be grateful for that.
Kingsley, today we've been talking about your new book, which, to remind listeners once again, is entitled The Phoenix Generation, A New Era of Connection, Compassion and Consciousness. That's widely available, but tell folks about anything else that you're working on that's coming up, where your work's going to be headed, and of course, share details of your website.
Okay, thanks, Greg. I would invite people to visit my website, www.kingsleydennis.com, or just Google my name, Kingsley Dennis. And on my website, I have a lot of articles. I publish articles and blog quite regularly, and it's the best way to find out about what I do and the books I've written. You can find out bio material, and I say and look me up and follow your nose and find out what information works for you. And I think that's the best way. Everyone to do their own homework, so to speak.
Wonderful. Well, Kingsley, thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thanks, Greg. It's been a pleasure as always. Cheers.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please check out the website. That's LegalizeFreedom.com, Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including world affairs, politics and economics, science and technology, religion and spirituality, conspiracy and alternative history. You can also browse and buy a range of books and DVDs from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.